A Pennsylvania Supreme Court justice is suspended from his job with pay while a state judicial ethics court considers allegations that his email practices have tainted the court system. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A three-judge panel of the Court of Judicial Discipline suspended Justice Michael Eakin this afternoon. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
The so-called Porngate scandal has ended the careers of several public officials who traded porn on their government computers. Eakin used a private Yahoo account with a pseudonym, but his email became public because some of his digital partners used government email servers. He faces a trial before the State Court of Judicial Discipline, which has now suspended him from the bench until his case is resolved. A 52-page complaint filed against Eakin earlier this month by the State Judicial Conduct Board gave detailed descriptions of his sexually explicit email, which it said detracts from the dignity of the court and undermines public confidence in the judiciary. Eakin's trial will be public. No date has been set. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
In the future, the Pennsylvania State Police will investigate when Philadelphia police officers fatally shoot suspects. One item on a long list of recommendations from the U.S. Department of Justice. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports that federal officials came to the city today to give an update of its examination of Philadelphia's police force.
In the past 6 months, the Ramsey-led department has launched nearly all of the DOJ's 91 recommendations. It'll take more time for full implementation, but the DOJ's Ron Davis was clearly impressed with the department's efforts.
I would say their progress is nothing less than amazing.
The original report said Philly police often shot out of fear, and the suspects involved were almost always African American. But after adopting dozens of new policies around firearm training and investigating shootings, officers are firing less often. To help guard against bias in the department's internal investigations, Ramsey says the state police will review all officer-involved shootings.
The perception is that it's biased because it is internal. And part of our responsibility is to see to it that we can do as much as possible to guarantee to the public that it is objective.
Ramsey says it's the little things that represent the culture change. For instance, the department has a new award for officers who de-escalate instead of firing their weapons.
What we want to do is make sure that our officers have the right training, we have the right policies in place.
The DOJ event marked the first time Ramsey's successor, Richard Ross, publicly supported identifying officers who use deadly force.
We got one of the greatest police chiefs in the country. I mean, why would I choose to do anything different? I believe that this law, it goes a long way towards transparency. It's what people want.
But a police union-backed bill in Harrisburg that aims to prevent naming those officers is gaining traction. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
A commission looking into New Jersey's gun laws thinks the state should clarify its rules on firearms and be more efficient in issuing permits. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, the findings may cause trouble for Governor Chris Christie as he campaigns for president.
Here's the main idea behind the recommendations. The process of obtaining a gun permit in New Jersey is confusing and slow because local governments aren't clear on the rules. That includes the justifiable need requirement an applicant has to meet to get a carry permit. The commission suggests clarifying those rules so every New Jerseyan knows exactly what it takes to get a gun permit. But Alexander Rubian with the New Jersey Second Amendment Society thinks it will bog down the process.
People know Governor Christie as the man that stood up to the unions and fought for pension reform, shut down Trenton. And the mere fact that he's not doing the same for us, for the Second Amendment, just goes to show that he doesn't really care about the issue.
Reactions like that will not help Christie as he campaigns to be the Republican nominee for president. Montclair University political science professor Bridget Harrison says the news comes at an inconvenient moment for Christie, who's been spending a lot of time courting New Hampshire voters.
New Hampshireans love their guns, and they tend to be, particularly within the GOP caucus, they tend to be really anti-gun control laws. So this is something that could be used against him by his opponents.
Despite the possible political fallout, the recommendations may not make a huge splash in the Garden State. UCLA law professor Adam Winkler says clearing up the state's gun laws may leave things pretty much the same.
It seems like this is more of an effort to try to clarify what the standard is rather than greatly expand or greatly diminish the number of permit holders.
The state attorney general now has the task of implementing these recommendations. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
In 1970, Gil Scott-Heron penned the poem and song, "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." 5 years ago, Malcolm Gladwell, author of The Tipping Point, opined that the revolution will not be tweeted. Well, now that notion is being challenged by a new study analysis of tens of millions of tweets. Joining me to discuss the salience of slacktivism in social movements is study co-author Sandra Gonzalez-Bayon, professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for inviting me.
The term slacktivist, one part slacker, and to me that implies either apathetic or certainly apolitical. How do you meld that with an activist and get a slacktivist?
Well, I think that was the intention, that contradiction, inherent contradiction, was the intention of the commentators that coined the term. What they wanted to highlight is that when you are retweeting a message or when you like a video or a photo, you're not really engaging in any political cause. You're essentially sort of giving a projection, an image of yourself. You want to make others believe that you are involved. And social media is encouraging that sort of lightweight engagement, but it's also maximizing exposure to information that might lead to recruitment to political causes. And I think that's what the commentators who started talking about slacktivism missed.
So tell us about the nature of the study.
So what we did in this study was to look at millions of tweets that were related to the protests that took place in Turkey in May of 2013. We also looked at communication around the Occupy campaign and the Spanish equivalent, the Indignados. And we separated out, using geolocated tweets, the users that were on the streets where the actions were taking place. In the case of the Turkish protest, that was Gezi Park. Those users that were most active formed the core of the network. And what we call the critical periphery are the vast amount of users that retweeted some of those messages that were coming from the core, but who, on an individual basis, whose engagement didn't go beyond that, retweeting.
Was it critical to have a minimal number, though, at the core to then disseminate out?
Yeah, so what happened in the Turkish protest is that during the first hours of the events, as the protest started being violent, mainstream media weren't covering those events. And so the participants that were at the court, they were documenting what was happening when no one else was. And what the users that we call the critical periphery, what they did was to amplify those messages, to give them international resonance, to allow that information to come out of the epicenter of the protests. But of course, you need those highly motivated users in the context of a protest to allow sort of political action to grow.
I'm wondering if, as time goes on, if somebody has a tendency to get involved in movements or social situations like this, he or she might not need to feel as motivated to get into the center of it, to put one's own life or skin in the game.
Yes, and this is one of the main criticisms that those who talk about slacktivism in a pejorative way, it's a pejorative term, this is one of the main criticisms, that it substitutes more genuine and meaningful ways of political engagement. But of course, you cannot make a protest to grow or a social movement to grow if you don't raise awareness about a cause. So the way I think about it is that being exposed to information is the first stepping stone in the process that might lead to higher levels of political engagement, but exposure to information is just one first step. And this is what social media are allowing social movements to maximize.
Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Sandra Gonzalez-Bayon, professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Taking a look at this evening's headlines, the landmark conviction of Monsignor William Lynn over his handling of child sexual abuse complaints against Philadelphia Archdiocese priests has been overturned for a second time. A Superior Court ruling today awarded Lynn a new trial. His lawyers say the trial judge allowed too many victims not closely related to the case to testify. They also say the law did not apply to church superiors such as Lynn. The Monsignor has been back in prison since the conviction overturned in 2013 was reinstated. He has served about 2 years of his 3 to 6 year term. A spokesperson for Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams says the office is still reviewing the Superior Court's opinion. Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter has signed an executive order allowing city officials to share some information about immigrants with federal authorities. Nutter says for immigrants in the country illegally who are suspected of terrorism, rape, robbery, or other first-degree felonies, city officials will inform the Homeland Security that they are being held in city prisons.
All we will do, if asked about an individual who has that background, is allow them to know when the person is being released from our custody. As part of this order, we're creating a new board that will provide ongoing oversight of the city's relationship with ICE and the Department of Homeland Security.
Nutter says he will not make appointments to the board, leaving that task to Mayor-elect Jim Kenney. Since November, Kenney has promised to reverse the executive order.
We're going to go back to where the original executive order that the mayor signed not that long ago and go back to trying to develop relationships between our immigrant communities and our police.
Kenney says any cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration officials creates fear and distrust in immigrant communities. Overcast, 58 degrees at 6:17. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. This evening's forecast, cloudy, falling back to 53 degrees. Showers again tomorrow, high 66. For Thursday, overcast with a 30% chance of rain, high all the way to 76 degrees. Still ahead, students at a West Philadelphia high school are creating Christmas tree ornaments with a Philadelphia flair, and they're learning about business at the same time.
I really treat it like this is like my real job. They're friends, but they're also like employees.
We'll take a look at some jaunaments as Newsworks Tonight continues.
There is no real cure for hearing the same 10 Christmas carols endlessly during the holidays, but one artist does try to spice it up a little.
You know, what I do is take a Christmas carol that's known in a certain way, and then I'll completely change what the perception is.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Mannheim Steamroller, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows Newsworks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
The sound of these voices means Christmas for so many people around the world. The men and boys of the choir of King's College, Cambridge, as they create magic each year with a festival of nine lessons and carols. I'm Michael Barone. Don't miss our live broadcast from England on Christmas Eve morning from American Public Media.
Thursday morning at 10 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. WHYY TV viewers who tune in Saturday afternoons at 1:30 for Lydia's Kitchen are quite familiar with the celebrity chef, author, and restaurateur Lydia Bastianich. On Christmas Eve, Thursday, December 24th at 8 in the evening, WHYY TV will debut the PBS special Lydia Celebrates America, Home for the Holidays. And Lydia has now come to our home, WHYY Studios. Thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure, Dave.
The title is so timely this winter season. Lydia Celebrates America, where there's so much back and forth over refugees and immigrants and rights and wrongs. And What a beautiful message of this program that we are all Americans and we all come from someplace else.
Exactly. Yeah, this is my fifth one-hour special that I did for PBS. And it always Lydia Celebrates America in some way. The mixture of people that make America, that make the great country that it is. And we have to cherish that and we have to celebrate that. I was born in Italy and I came here when I was 12. And I'm very American, but I can be Italian too and speak my language and with no problems. And this is what America allows us all to do.
We'll talk about your celebrity guest list, but as you brought up your past, yes, you came here at age 12, but there were some tough years between 10 and 12.
Yeah, right after World War II. So Istria, where I was born, was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia. And for the first 10 years of my life, I was caught in that situation. In 1956, as a family, we went into a political refugee camp in Trieste, San Saba. It is now a museum there.
A former concentration camp during World War II.
It was. The Nazi used it as a. And we stayed there for 2 years. And then in 1958, Dwight Eisenhower opened immigration for people fleeing communism, and we came to the United States.
So now let's get to that renowned dinner table. And you already cited her. The highest profile guest is your 94-year young mother.
Somehow she steals this show, David. I don't know why, but it's just great. I mean, she still lives with me. You know, the courage that it took for them to take their children and go into the unknown. And, you know, with all that's happening today, I can't help but, you know, just rethink and reappreciate ever more.
So you're a young girl around age 12, and in your neighborhood in New York, there's a bakery owned by a Mr. Walken, and lo and behold, he has a son named Chris.
Right. And I went in and I lied. I was a big girl and I said, I'm 16 and I'm looking for a weekend job. And they did. They gave me a sales group job for Saturdays and Sundays. And then that's how I met the family. Then my mother came to work there. So we've been family friends ever since.
Gosh, in the broader sense, could we say this was the first time you made money working with food?
I think it is. Yeah, it is. But Dave, you know, this event that ultimately culminated in all of my special guests and friends sitting at a Christmas dinner table at my house. Christopher Walken, Rita Moreno, Anne Curry, Padma Lakshmi, Mark Samuelson, and Carlo Ponti Jr.
That's pretty much an A-list.
Oh, they're great. They're icons in the American culture. And yet, you know what? They all went back to their ethnicity, to their childhood, for their favorite things. And when Christmas came around the table, they all came out with a special dish that they like.
The ever-busy Lydia, you've just written another book called Lydia's Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine. I'll just ask on behalf of those who might wonder about the book, is it always a no-no to open up a box of pasta and prepare that way? Should it always be freshly made?
No. No, no. Where did you get that idea?
No, I'm just saying.
Maybe one would think that if you make homemade pasta, you put all that effort and it is lighter and whatever. But nothing beats a good pasta, a dry spaghetti with linguine, with clam sauce or something. I just adore dry pasta, and it's easy. You can pull it together quickly. So no, absolutely. Food does not need to be complicated. And I really enjoy demystifying and presenting it. I mean, in here, I have over 400 recipes, and some are traditional, some are Italian-American, some are the innovative. So the basic recipes that you expect are here. But I have all about the techniques, you know, braising, steaming, boiling, roasting, dry roasting, wet roasting, grilling, you know. And once you understand the techniques, then, you know, you have a piece of meat or fish. Oh, I'm going to grill it. I'm going to sear it. I'm going to whatever. And so these kind of things are all throughout the book.
I have so many more questions, but now I'm salivating. I can't go on. You've been very generous. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, David.
Lydia Bastianich. Her TV special, Lydia Celebrates America, Home for the Holidays, airs Thursday, December 24th at 8 in the evening. Her new book is called Lydia's Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Great Italian Cook. For the second year in a row, students at a West Philadelphia high school are producing Jonamans, Christmas tree decor immortalizing a piece of Philly slang. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports the enterprise has taken off, and students as young as 15 are learning how to run a small business.
So, what's a Jonamans? For starters, let's define John. If you're not from Philly, Workshop School senior Jate Williams explains it this way.
It's a person, a place, or a thing. It's a noun. Like, a John is anything you want it to be.
Last year, one student had the idea to turn that unique Philly slang word into a Christmas ornament. The Jonamant was born. The colorful woodcut ornaments were a hit with local media and shoppers at craft sales. Eventually, the students had to cancel some orders because they couldn't make them fast enough. This year, they're upping their game with a new website for online orders and a bigger team of workers.
We need some more bubble wrap. Where's my laptop?
About 15 students work to the constant hum of a laser cutter that turns plywood into Johns and a host of other holiday shapes like snowflakes and stars. They're painted and sold for $4 or $5 a pop. The Workshop School is all about project-based learning, but this endeavor is part of a special after-school program called Workshop Industries. Director Bevan Weissman says the students get a cut of the profits.
One of the biggest motivators is that they realize it's making a lot of money, and it's a really good source of revenue for them and for the school.
So far, Jonamit sales have grossed about $7,000 this year, three times more than they brought in last year, although the students are still calculating the cost of supplies and shipping. With that kind of money on the line, Weissman says there's more pressure on them to get through challenges. He's only there to supervise.
I want to be as hands-off as possible, so it's my goal for them to just really take total ownership of it.
I want you to paint a board that color and make the big part.
Miracle Towns, a sophomore, is the team manager. Towns is soft-spoken, but firm when she has to be. She wants to be a CEO someday, but it's not easy being in charge of her friends.
It's kind of hard, like, because when I come here, basically, I really treat it like this is, like, my real job. They're friends, but they're also, like, employees. So it's kind of hard because I have to be very precise on things.
Towns has to tell her team exactly what she needs. Otherwise, orders could go unfulfilled, and they could all lose money. There are other lessons to learn, like how to make a sale pitch or how to keep your cool while waiting in long lines at the post office. The biggest challenge, says sophomore Michael Best, is deciding how to split the profits. Best came up with the Jonamit idea and says the money talk got pretty tense last year.
Yes, it did cause fights. We had lots of arguments, and people would say, like, they did the most, and then they really didn't do the most.
When the team squabbles over pay, that's when Weissman steps back in to help. They are still students, after all. But how much money are we talking? Best made $250 last year, and he expects to make a whole lot more this year. He says, sure, the money is good. But he also loves the idea of his Jonamits hanging on Christmas trees all over Philly and as far away as Washington State. Katie Colinari, WHYY News. It's the
Check out the Jonamits and visit the workshop at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll review Mayor Michael Nutter's legacy on business development from a neighborhood perspective as he prepares to leave office. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Cabrini College is proud to support WHYY, now offering part-time doctoral degrees in organizational development and educational leadership. Cabrini can help you earn a PhD or EdD in 3 years without giving up your life. Their faculty and small classes help to expand your knowledge and professional network while giving you the tools to advance your career. More information on Cabrini's professional doctoral programs is available at cabrini.edu/doc.
What is it to be human? What is it to ache? What is it to be alive?
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the directors of the new animated film Anomalisa, Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson. Kaufman also wrote the film, as well as the film's Being John Malkovich adaptation and The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.
Frederick Living supports WHYY. Frederick Living, a continuing care retirement community nestled in the beautiful countryside of Montgomery County, is proud to announce the expansion of their campus. The meadows at Frederick Living will consist of 55 cottages clustered in an innovative design based on the pocket neighborhood concept. Frederick Living is now taking reservations. Visits can be scheduled by calling 610-754-7878. That's 610-754-7878. Frederick Living. Live well.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, protecting individuals and businesses from damaging or inaccurate information in online search results. Learn more at Reputation.com.
One hates to say this, but sometimes one has to do what one has to do. This might be as good as it gets economically for a while, gang.